its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. For those of you who spend more money on gasoline than you would like, which is probably upwards of 100% of you, I would imagine. An encouraging headline in this morning's paper, U.S. gasoline prices are headed to a three-year low. They are poised to drop to the lowest since February 2011 by New Year's Eve as supplies increase more than demand, providing a lift for consumers in an economy struggling to recover from the deepest recession since the 1930s. Retail prices will probably sink to an average of, this is encouraging, or it feels encouraging, $3.15 by the end of the year from about $3.33. This is according to a spokesman in Washington for AAA, as reported by Bloomberg News' Barbara Powell and the Detroit News' Michael Martinez. We have got a busy show here for you today. We hope you can stick close. Yesterday, we got our first look at a new, long-anticipated building project in downtown Lansing. The Gillespie Group tweeted the photo of its marketplace project yesterday, about a month after breaking ground near the intersection of Cedar and Shiawassee Streets, north of downtown. The marketplace project has endured some challenges. Last spring, the development had to overcome a threat of legal action. Lansing's top economic development executive, Bob Trezise of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, said the city was considering action against the Gillespie Group over an alleged delay in breaking ground. However, the differences were settled shortly thereafter. Joining us to update progress on downtown Lansing's marketplace project by phone, Pat Gillespie of the Gillespie Group. Hi, Pat.
Morning, Mark. How you doing?
Real well. Now, along with the rendering, you tweeted, "It's a great day." How important a threshold is the rendering?
Well, it feels good. Footings are going in. We start the elevator pits this morning, so the sewer and water's in. We're moving forward. It's been, like you said, 5-6 years of anticipated fun between the economy, but it's moving now. The market is there as far as the demand for housing. It's off the charts downtown Lansing, so we feel now's a great time to bring 80 more units online and more people downtown.
Give us a few more specs on the project, just to refresh our memory here, Pat. It's an 80-unit, five-story development?
Well, this is a four-acre site. It was the home of the old city market. They built a new one. The first building is 80 units, five stories tall. They're all looking at the river. Half of them will be looking at the river and across the river from the accident fund. The other half will be looking back towards the east, towards the minor league baseball stadium. And then we have room for three more buildings on the site that will come, as time moves on and the market continues to develop. So we think there's a real strong demand for these 80 units, though. They'll all be for rent, and they'll be about $900 to $1,000 a month.
What do you think will attract residents to Marketplace? And what in a larger picture, what continues to attract residents to downtown Lansing?
Well, we have a Stadium District project and a Pruden project that has 120 to 130 units downtown right now. Every single unit is full, and they're probably full for the next 3 to 4 months. The demand is strong, so people are really liking the urban feel. They like being near the river trail. They like the short commute to whether they got to go east or west from here. We have a lot of Sparrow, Cooley, MSU, government workers, lobbyists, mature professionals. It's the urban market is just really popular right now. So a lot of people like the features that are down there. As far as the marketplace, we look at the city market being an organic grocery store on their first floor where they can get coffee or there's a bar restaurant there. So it's a cool amenity to have on the lower level of your building.
Pat, I've begun to hear from other people expressing fears that a housing glut may actually be approaching here in the Lansing area. How closely are you monitoring other residential developments around Lansing, and are you beginning to share any of that concern?
You know what? I think there may be a housing glut coming up with student housing. There's a lot of three-bedroom, three-bath housing units going up for students. We don't really get a lot of students. Well, most of ours are Jackson National Life and auto owners and accident fund. These urban professionals, these young professionals that are moving back to town for these jobs, that want to live urban and they don't want to live in the suburbs in a vinyl-sided apartment. We have a lot of vinyl-sided apartments, but so I'm not downplaying them, but they want this urban experience, and that's the workers they're attracting and recruiting. So, you know, there's a huge demand for that right now. There's, you know, as we said, every unit we have downtown is full. So I don't think there's a glut downtown. I think there may be a glut in some pockets of East Lansing as we get, you know, in the suburbs, maybe Chandler Road area and some of these other areas that have been building like mad. But the downtown Lansing, I think, is ripe for actually more than these 80 units we're building.
We're talking with developer Pat Gillespie of the Gillespie Group about the Marketplace project, which has broken ground here in downtown Lansing, about development in general and about that development in particular. I did allude to delays. I mean, you were later breaking ground in this project, I think, than you originally anticipated. I imagine every developer is aware of how costly delays can be. Are you paying a price for the delay at Marketplace?
Oh, yeah, we paid a tremendous price. We, you know, carried the taxes and the insurance and the upkeep of the land and, you know, just carrying cost on the money. It's been very expensive for us to sit and wait, but there was a lot of things that happened over the last couple of years, you know, the economy, the recession, the lack of financing, and then a casino announces, and we're asked, you know, by the city to hold off for a while and not do anything, you know, so we can complement the casino if it comes and not put buildings where, you know, they would want to put a building. So, you know, there was a good 12 months of tinkering with that as well. So lots of variables. We were able to overcome them, and we're excited to move on.
Well, now Bob Trezise suggested you were in violation of your agreement with the city. As you just mentioned, you countered that the casino plan delayed matters there. Still, it appears your dispute with LEAP or the city has been resolved. How tense did that get, and is there any lingering tension there?
I have no lingering tension. I think once they reviewed the agreement that they said I was in violation of, they changed their mind about that determination.
Okay.
So once, I think not everyone was looking at the right document, and once everyone got on the same page at the city, I think they said, let's just move on and get this thing done. We were not in violation.
So it was just, you were not on the same page.
We were not on the same page, and we were not in violation. So, but we all worked together to make a good thing happen, and it's moving forward.
As a developer, I'd be very interested in your perspective on some of the other developments around town. You've alluded to some of them kind of in passing here. Do you have a particular perspective on the Red Cedar project, which has been as anticipated as yours, but the silence has become deafening?
Oh, no, that's not mine. The city's working with a couple quality developers to get that done, and we're cheering that on. We have some land across the street at the Sears building and the old Silver Dollar Saloon site. So first, we would love to see that. I think they're talking anywhere from $150 to $200 million worth of development on the Red Cedar site. From what I'm hearing, it could happen. They could announce something in the next couple months, I'm hearing. I'm hopeful, because that helps that whole region, that whole district.
I've had some real estate professionals tell me the market has turned on a dime recently, going from a buyer's to a seller's market. Would you agree? And if so, how has that altered your expectations of the Marketplace project?
It has changed dramatically. For example, at the Stadium District, we have out of 100,000 square feet, we've been sitting on 4,200 square feet waiting for a bar restaurant for about five years. In the last 3 weeks, we have had 9 meetings with different bar restaurants from either in-town or out-of-town looking at that space. Things are just, I mean, the phone calls are picking up. There are people looking to expand their offices, make new offices. So I would agree with you that things are really exploding. I think that bodes well for Marketplace. You know, when you look at Jackson National Life adding 1,200 new jobs, and most of those folks are going to make really good money, and a lot of them are going to be young, educated, and eclectic. They're looking for that type of housing. So do I need 80 units or do I need 500 units? I think it's closer to 500 than 80.
Wow.
So there's a market.
Interest rates have begun going up. How is that impacting your business?
They've gone up, but historically, they're still historically low. I mean, they're in the bottom part of any interest rate we've ever seen. We have a lot of stuff we had locked at 7.5% for a 10-year period of time, and now you can borrow money at, you know, 4.2%. Makes a big difference in three different, you know, if it goes up another half point, you know, it's still historically low. Another point, it's still historically low. So you don't build for today. These buildings sit around for 20, 30, 40 years. It's a long, you know, real estate's a long-term game, so you got to, it's got to make economic sense for a long term, not just, you know, today's interest rate.
I hope you don't mind me alluding to some of these other projects that are in the news all the time that are not necessarily yours. It's just interesting to have a have somebody's perspective on it with you on the phone and all. Are you willing to comment on DTN's plans for the Park District in East Lansing?
I met with them last week. I think they are the right developer for that site. I mean, they know the market better than anyone else as far as the student housing market. And the best thing is you have a group of guys at DTN that live here and care about the community. That's all they talked about when we were meeting the other day is we want to make a positive difference in East Lansing. We want to make a positive difference for this campus town. And that was refreshing. It wasn't some developer from a different town coming in to make a buck and get out. They were concerned about how it's going to look, how it's going to feel. The impact that they could make on the community was the number one thing they talked about. It wasn't about rate of return or how much money we can make, or it was what kind of positive difference can we make in the long term for East Lansing. And as a community resident, I was thrilled that they took that kind of tone. They can pull it off. They're financially capable and they're creative, and they are the right developers for this. I'm thoroughly convinced of that.
3 years ago, before he became the head of LEAP, Bob Trezise said that Lansing development was about 15 years behind Grand Rapids. Was that true then?
That was true then, and we're still behind. We're still behind Columbus and Madison and Indianapolis and Nashville and Grand Rapids, all these cities we'd like to emulate. I mean, that's what people say. Where do you get some of your ideas? I go to those other cities, and I don't want to use the word copy, but we mimic what's working there and bring it here. Because there are things that are working, you know, drastically well, and others, communities that we have yet to grasp. So it's kind of frustrating to a certain point, but it's nice to see a bright horizon that we don't have all that stuff yet. So there's room for growth.
Who is to blame for Lansing falling 15 years behind? Is that the city administration? Is that the private sector? Is it voters? The city council? Where does the blame lay there? If blame is to be assigned.
I don't know if there is any, there's not any one body or person that does that. I just think our general, Lansing, we've got this, I'm born and raised here, and so I know a lot of the folks that are here, our perception is that we're not this or we're not that, but we can be. We have a lot of the same things that Madison and Columbus have, a capital city, a major university, some major employers and insurance arms and automotive arms. It's almost like we thought we weren't good enough or we weren't ready for that, but we're ready. And I think you're seeing a lot of different things changing now. People are looking, thinking a little bigger, thinking a little broader and saying, you know, we're not going to be Madison, but we can be, this part of Madison. We're not going to be Grand Rapids, but we can, be better than Grand Rapids in a certain thing. So I think the eyes have been opened and we're dreaming a little bigger now.
Pat Gillespie, a pleasure to talk to you. Continued success with the Marketplace Project. We'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Have a great day. See ya.
There's some encouraging news out this week in the realm of HIV research. A report published Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine indicates a 3-year-old girl from Mississippi born with the AIDS virus is now in remission. The child was treated with strong antiviral medication but stopped that regimen 18 months ago. This finding may lead to a deeper understanding of how to fight the epidemic that first surfaced in the U.S. more than 30 years ago. Now, outside of Metro Detroit, Ingham County has the highest rate of HIV infection in Michigan. Over half those cases are among gay men, most of whom are first diagnosed with HIV after the age of 30. We're joined today by Todd Haywood, a senior reporter for the American Independent News Network. He's covered the topic of HIV and AIDS extensively for several years. Todd,
that's
good,
great
to see you. And Dwayne Riley, who is the prevention coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Dwayne, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
What data do we have, about HIV infection rates in Michigan then, Todd, and specifically Ingham County?
In Ingham County, I think probably for me the most stunning statistic is that right now 1 in 5 cases in Ingham County are in 13 to 24-year-olds. That's 6% in 13 to 19-year-olds and 14% in 20 to 24-year-olds. So one in five cases are in people 13 to 24. Those are the identified cases. And we know that with young people in that age group in particular, 60% of the people who are infected don't know. So there's a high probability that those numbers are significantly higher than we currently know.
And how is that data obtained?
I'll let Dwayne,
that's more your bailiwick.
But with that data right there, so with prevention, when we're testing individuals, you have to obtain a lot of data about each person. Mm-hmm. And so with that data right there, once someone tests positive, you have to send it to the health department. Once it's into the health department, the Michigan Department of Community Health crunches those numbers right there, and then they obtain statistics about each individual, about the population as a whole, and the infections rate and who is infected with different subgroups.
So reporting ends up playing a key factor in the data. Is it accurate to say that the county's high HIV infection rate is a product of a stronger rate of reporting?
I would not say that. I think that part of the problem that we're dealing with here is that Ingham County rests right in the middle between Detroit and Grand Rapids. So we become a way stop. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of MSM who are coming into our community to go to the bars, and our community is going to Grand Rapids and
MSM.
To Detroit. That's men who have sex with men, and that's the behavioral label that's used by health officials to describe gay, bisexual, and transgender women, actually, because it describes behavior instead of
an identity.
I see. Now, HIV is an issue that waxes and wanes in the media. I think it's safe to say 30 years ago it was virtually a death sentence. What strides have been made in the way of antiviral drugs, and how have they enhanced a person's quality of life?
Sure. Well, as a person living with HIV since 2007, I've been on medication, and I can tell you that if I had not started medications when I did, I would probably be dead at this point. I started medications as my health began to decline. And when I started the medications, my CD4s went up, my viral load disappeared. And what we're finding now is that people who have a suppressed viral load, which is the measure of virus in your blood, are significantly less likely to transmit the virus. In fact, it's so significant that the federal government, state government, and World Health Organization are now pushing everybody to get tested for HIV, and those who are positive to go on medication right away, because they believe that it could stop the transmission of the virus.
Lower viral load.
That's correct.
Is really what's in play here. Dwayne, are younger patients today, are younger men today, lured into a sense of complacency by any chance? Do they take the threat as seriously as gay men did a generation ago?
I think gay men, MS, we refer to them as MSM, of course, because it's more inclusive of individuals who have anal sex, you know, with other men. And so I think when you're talking about HIV, specifically with Ingham County, individuals are more aware of the fact that this epidemic primarily affects our, you know, community. I'm someone who identifies as gay man as well, and so I think that we're becoming more understanding of how it affects us and how we can reduce our particular risk for HIV.
Todd, how does being HIV positive, how has that affected your daily life?
Overall, it really hasn't had a big impact on my daily life. Mm. I think, you know, in the big scope of things, and Mark, you've known me for years. You know that I'm involved and engaged in doing things.
I do.
I was diagnosed in July of 2007, actually, while I was directing Julius Caesar. And I was diagnosed because I had pneumonia. And what I have found is that I don't have the same energy to direct a show, work full-time plus, and continue doing a bunch of other things and only sleep 3 hours a night, which is what I used to do.
Yeah.
So, and that could also just be a side effect of the fact that I'm now 40, but actually I'm 43, truth told. But that's really been the biggest thing. But I do spend a lot of time having to go to doctors and having blood drawn and that sort of stuff. And I have to take my pills every day.
Mm-hmm. You seem very animated and healthy right now, though. I mean, you seem well.
I am doing well. I have an undetectable viral load, and I have now for 3 years. My highest viral load was not very high ever, but my CD4s, which is the cells that the virus destroys, kept dropping. And when they got to about 300, which is less than half of normal, my doctor and I said, okay, let's go ahead and start the medication.
Let's talk about federal and state legislation here for just a second, governing same-sex relationships. Does that legislation affect a person's willingness to disclose their status, their HIV status?
Well, I'll take a jump at it, and then I'll let you build on it. Absolutely, it does impact. And actually, I think we're seeing a bigger impact than people's willingness to actually even get tested for HIV. Michigan has HIV is the only felony disease in the state of Michigan. No other disease carries a criminal penalty to it for disclosure. But in Michigan, before a person who's HIV positive can have any sexual penetration, quote, however slight, end quote, they must disclose their HIV positive status or they've committed a 4-year felony. And what the message now to people who are going in to get tested who are at most risk, the message they're hearing is take the test and risk arrest. Because the ultimate defense in that scenario is if I don't know my status, I can't be charged with a felony.
We're talking with Todd Haywood, who is a reporter for the American Independent News Network, and Dwayne Riley, prevention coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network, about HIV in Ingham County. So many more states, we've seen such a dramatic change in attitudes toward same-sex marriage and civil unions. What impact is that having?
I think with the same-sex marriage and with just the idea that's surrounding it, it's stigma, and it stigmatizes individuals who are gay, who identify with same-sex relationships. And with that right there, it's another barrier for them to actually get tested, as Todd was talking about. You know, it definitely affects our culture, you know, as the LGBTQ community. And so I think that once we're able to have that barrier removed right there, then more individuals will come in and get tested and take control of their sexual health.
Is there an awareness in public health that sex education messaging also needs to be tailored to the LGBT community?
I think there absolutely is an acknowledgement of that reality. I think part of what we're stuck with, though, is the way the federal funding for prevention is shaped out. You know, Michigan only uses federal funds for HIV prevention. We don't use a single penny in state funds. And we're currently facing, by the end of 2014, we'll have a 33% reduction in those funds. But we're limited. 75% of those funds have to go to address people who are living with HIV and then 25% has to go towards people who are high risk. Yet what we know is that a person who does not know that they are living with HIV is 3.5 times more likely to transmit the virus than a person who does know.
And who's on medication, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because as Todd was talking about, you have the thing called viral load. So if someone who's never been diagnosed, oftentimes they have a much higher viral load and rate of infection when engaging in sexual behavior. So if we, like, reallocate those funds to prevention, I think that we'll be at a better look as far as ending this particular epidemic, specifically within the Ingham County area. So. Mm-hmm.
How long have you been the prevention coordinator, Dwayne?
I've been in Lansing for 2 months, but I've been working in prevention for the past couple of years.
What have you, just 2 months?
Yeah.
What have you
at Lansing Area AIDS Network.
Okay, in the current position. Uh-huh. What have you learned about the landscape in the greater Lansing area with regard to HIV just in those 2 months?
I think Lansing is very conservative as opposed to other places. And
Where were you before Lansing?
I was working previously in Ann Arbor, and before that I was working in Detroit.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so I think Lansing is pretty conservative in regards to just the idea that HIV exists here. And, you know, the numbers don't lie. So it's like, as you said, it's a second county with the highest incidence rate or prevalence of HIV as opposed, you know, it's right next to Wayne County, and so the Detroit area. And so knowing that that actually exists, that's absent within Lansing. You know, we ignore the problem versus actually trying to address it. And so...
Is your job harder here in Lansing? That sounds like that would make your job harder here in Lansing than it was in Ann Arbor.
It makes it a little bit more difficult, but you know, even though the Lansing area as a whole is very conservative, there are individuals, particularly within the gay community. You have the individuals who are, you know, owners of clubs and things of that nature, and or venues in which, you know, MSM go, that are very open to us coming in and doing testing. And so you have those exceptions, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But as a whole, it, you know, it's a very conservative environment, I think so.
Is the social stigma of HIV wearing away over the years?
No, it's getting worse.
It's getting
much worse.
Yeah. How is it getting worse and why?
Well, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, Americans, 6 out of 10 Americans get their information from news about HIV. And as you noted, we don't cover the news very well. And I'm about HIV, and I'm guilty of that myself. In fact, you opened this up with a story that's actually about 6 months old, 7 months old, and a story that actually is pretty inaccurate.
Let's correct that.
The baby actually is not the first baby to have been, quote, cured at birth with antiretrovirals. It's actually sort of standard practice. This is just a curious case because the child dropped out of care for 18 months and then came back into care. We also have adults who, with early antiretroviral treatment in France, were able to create undetectable viral loads without any medication. And we've actually had a couple of cures now, actual cures, functional cures, where people's bone marrow has been obliterated and replaced with a specific genetic defect that's found in about 5% of white people that prevents the virus from replicating. And those people have been absolutely cured. Timothy Ray Brown was the first. He's known as the Berlin patient. And he's been cured now for 5 years.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for the clarification. We appreciate that. What about the incidence of HIV among heterosexuals? How are heterosexuals contracting HIV?
I think with increased risk, with prevention, we constantly talk about risk. And so individuals who share needles, it definitely increases their risk for HIV. Individuals who engage, who have partners who are HIV positive or discordant couples, they definitely have an increased risk for HIV and a higher incidence of HIV infections. And so with the heterosexual community in general, there is a lower risk. However, when you have those other factors that are into play, it definitely increases their risk and furthermore, you know, increases the incidence of HIV infections.
Todd, you're suggesting that we've got quite a ways. Well, you've both suggested that you think we've got quite a ways to go here with regard to HIV testing, funding, legislation, et cetera, et cetera. What's next in this fight against HIV/AIDS in Michigan as far as you're concerned? What's really at the top of your list?
I think it's important to recognize that we stand at a point right now today for the first time in the history of this epidemic where we could begin to stop it. We actually could stop this epidemic in a decade.
And what would it? What would make
it's
that
gonna,
happen?
It's going to require additional funding. It's also going to require
state
and federal. And it's going to require a refocusing and reharnessing of our prevention messaging. You know, there's tons of science out there that now shows that there are multiple ways to prevent infection, including the use of antiretroviral drugs as a daily dose, which is about 80% effective in preventing infection. Post-exposure prophylaxis, which is where if a person is exposed to the virus, if they take the medications within 72 hours, they'll prevent infection. Mm. It was born in 1987 as part of the response to the AIDS epidemic in healthcare workers. We know that there's science now that shows specific behavioral choices will help reduce risk even without using condoms. Yet all of these things are sort of out of our reach in terms of talking about because we can't talk about them through federal funding.
Mm-hmm. Todd Haywood is a senior reporter for the American Independent News Network. He's been a Lansing fixture for many years. And Duane Riley is the prevention coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network, LAN. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. its current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Earlier this week, we spoke with Michigan Public Service Commission Chair John Quackenbush about draft reports published to guide Michigan's energy future. One of the many issues addressed in the report was electric choice and the deregulation of utilities. In deregulated markets, consumers are allowed to choose their utility supplier, but a new report suggests deregulation may not be the right choice for Michigan. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Public Sector's report details some of the drawbacks faced by states who have deregulated. Ken Sikkema, welcome to Current State.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you on the show. To give us some context, what exactly triggered the push for deregulation back in the 90s?
Well, Mark, this really started with Enron, a large company that wanted to deregulate electric markets. They promoted this idea in the mid to the late 1990s, and California started the trend, and a number of other states quickly, as I say, drank the Kool-Aid. But Enron, a sorry story of fraud, and the company imploded. California immediately experienced a lot of problems with rolling blackouts and rate spikes. And so although a number of states followed California's lead, the vast majority of states decided not to pursue deregulation. In fact, there's really only 14 states out of the 50 that have deregulated electric markets. The theory was that Enron promoted was you could deregulate the electric energy market like you could deregulate airlines or deregulate the trucking industry. But the uniqueness of providing electricity really indicates that that's a problem. Now, Public Sector Consultants, we just published this week, we looked at three states in the country that have deregulated, three of the 14, one on the East Coast, Texas, and one here in the Midwest, Illinois. That have deregulated. We looked at their experience over 14 years, and our reports document some of the serious problems that these states have encountered and experienced. And by implication, we're saying that Michigan needs to look at their experience and seriously consider them before we pursue any deregulation strategy.
Why don't I cite some of the arguments that backers of deregulation point to on a regular basis, and maybe you can use some of the examples from New Jersey, Illinois, and Texas to refute them. They point to Michigan's exorbitant electricity rates right now, quite a bit higher than in a number of surrounding states, and the market is desperately in need of competition and choice. How did that play out in Texas, Illinois, and New Jersey?
Well, first of all, we need to kind of put Michigan and that argument in some kind of context here. The deregulated states in the country, and I mentioned there are 14 of them, their rates are about 30% higher on average than all the states that have maintained regulated markets. So deregulation has not been an effective strategy if the goal is to lower rates. And New Jersey and Texas are good examples of that. New Jersey had the six highest rates in the country when they started this 14 years ago. In fact, the reason New Jersey did this is because of their high rates. Well, 14 years later, New Jersey still has the six highest rates in the country.
That seems counterintuitive. Why didn't it work? We can point to other industries where competition's been introduced and there's a downward trend in prices. Why?
Well, it's really the unique nature of this industry. You have to invest billions of dollars into generating facilities, whether they're coal plants, wind turbines, natural gas plants, and these are long-term investments. And what really drives rates is not whether you're at a regulated or a deregulated market. What really drives rates are structural aspects like the price of natural gas, which goes up and down. Michigan, in fact, for the first 8 years of this decade, 2000 to 2008, allowed what I would call 100% choice. But the fact of the matter is very few customers took advantage of that because the rates, natural gas rates, and the rates on the wholesale markets were very high. And so it's really things like the price of natural gas and other structural issues that drive rates. It's not whether the market is deregulated or regulated. And once again, Mark, it's because of the unique nature of this industry. Billions of dollars are required to provide the investments that you need when you flip the switch and want the power on. The other issue that's unique to this industry that is not unique to any other industry is that the whole issue of making sure the power is there when you want it. That means that in this industry, you have to have reserve capacity. You have to have enough power to fulfill demand no matter what that demand is. Now, for most of the year, that power sits idle. But when you have that really hot 100-degree day in August and you want your air conditioner to work, or if you're a business and you want your machines to run, you have to have power. And so you need a reserve capacity that, frankly, sits there idle much of the year but is there when you need it.
Let me bring up another argument of backers of greater deregulation. They claim that manufacturers and other Michigan businesses, who we are extremely interested in keeping in Michigan, become extremely tempted to relocate to other states with lower rates. And is it not true that Michigan's rates are currently higher than a lot in the surrounding states?
Well, actually, the fact of the matter is that most businesses, whether you're talking large, medium, or small businesses, they want reliable power and stable prices. They're not out there every day trying to find the cheapest power they can get on a day-to-day basis. It's more important to them that the power is there when they need it and that you don't have volatile rates, you know, big spikes, you know, mountains and valleys in terms of the rate structure.
They're willing to pay for dependability.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. They want dependability. They want reliable power, and they want stable prices. Michigan, and I already mentioned this in terms of, you know, the average rates in a deregulated states are 30% higher than regulated states. Michigan rates are lower than the vast majority of states that have deregulated. And the rate structure is actually less important than your monthly bill. Most consumers, most residents, look at their monthly bill, not the rate itself. And Michigan's bills, what's coming out of the pocket of consumers, are actually lower than the national average.
We've got a 10% cap right now. Is there a middle ground here? What do you make of Michigan's 10% status right now in terms of energy choice?
You know, this cap of 10% on energy choice was part of a larger energy package that the legislature passed in 2008. Governor Granholm was governor. You had a Democratic House, a Republican Senate. My own view and the research that we have done at public sector consultants over a number of years indicates that a fully regulated market is a far better strategy if your goals are reliability, stable prices, and long-term economic growth. So my view, Mark, is that we ought to return to a fully regulated market.
Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. We've been talking electricity deregulation here in Michigan and the experience in several other states, Texas, Illinois, and New Jersey. Thanks, Ken.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. The moose is one of the largest and most elusive land animals in North America. Its habitat extends from Alaska south to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Moose were once found in both the Upper and Lower Peninsulas. Now they're concentrated in a few isolated areas of the state. In recent years, scientists have watched an alarming drop in the moose population in Michigan and in Minnesota. One possible explanation may be an increase in winter ticks. These are parasites that feed on the blood of moose, elk, and caribou. Now, the rise in ticks may be attributed to warmer temperatures, which could be further evidence of global warming. Here to talk about the status of moose in Michigan is Paul Brown. He's the Chief of Natural Resources at Isle Royale National Park, way up north above the UP and Lake Superior. Paul Brown, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Talk to us about the contribution that moose make to the ecosystem of Isle Royale. What place do they occupy?
Moose are our primary herbivore on the island, and so the moose make a significant impact on the overall forest ecology by the way that they browse and what they eat. They affect what the landscape of the island actually looks like.
And in recent years, I mean, moose were once found both in the upper and the lower peninsula here. How many moose are known to be in Michigan now?
Well, if you count Isle Royale, there's around 1,500. Isle Royale occupies just 1% of the land mass of the Upper Peninsula, but holds 65% of the state's moose population.
Wow, okay.
So there's roughly 1,000 moose on Isle Royale, which is the long-term average for the last 60 years. And there are about 400 in the western Upper Peninsula and about 100 moose in the eastern Upper Peninsula. So Isle Royale makes a significant portion of that Michigan population.
I guess so. According to an article published this week in Great Lakes Echo, this is a publication of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at MSU, quote, moose numbers studied in the western Upper Peninsula between 1997 and 2007 showed a growth rate of about 10% a year, but now that rate has slowed to about 2%. Scientists believe this may be traced to an infestation of winter ticks. What role are these ticks playing?
Well, ticks are a parasite that feed on the blood of moose. So there are some anecdotal evidence that suggests that heavy infestations can actually cause the death of the animal outright. Typically what happens is you just get this heavy parasite load that weakens the animal and makes them more susceptible to predation. It affects their winter coats, and so they're more susceptible to winter weather. And just generally it's an overall decline in their health based on the tick infestation.
And
some of these animals can have, you know, 10,000 or more ticks. So you can imagine if you had, you know, one tick is irritating to us. You can imagine what it'd be like to have 10,000 of them on you all winter long.
And is it clear to you that the ticks are increasing in numbers because it's getting warmer?
I wouldn't go that far. There is some evidence that suggests that warm weather allows ticks to survive better and extend their range more north. And so we're getting to see more ticks in areas that you hadn't previously been seeing them as much. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that warmer weather is definitely allowing ticks to survive better and causing more problems with the animals that they affect, both winter ticks and other tick species.
We're talking with Paul Brown, who is talking to us from Isle Royale National Park. Paul is the Chief of Natural Resources at Isle Royale. Paul, to what degree can we tell the difference between natural selection and man-made ecological disruption? Do you see that playing, either what of those do you see playing out on Isle Royale?
I think it really just is very specific to the issue at hand. There are some things which seem to point toward man-made influences. There are other things that are natural variation.
Can you give us an example of each one?
Well, we think that there is a couple species of fish that live on Isle Royale that may have disappeared because of rising water temperatures on the inland lakes. So these lakes are getting too warm in the summertime, and they're above the known lethal temperature for the animals.
Are these are these fish that our listeners would be aware of?
Well, they're a a species that people would be familiar with. We're not done with our study yet, so we're not really ready to describe in detail what we think is happening. But that is something that we're actively researching on the island, is that we may have had a species go extinct relative to warming water temperatures. But that's still data that's being processed right now.
You can't identify the fish then?
I can, but I'd rather not at this point, where it's, like I said, we haven't finally analyzed all of our data yet.
Okay.
We're not willing. Just because we haven't found them doesn't mean that they're not there.
Okay.
And so
understood.
So we've been looking for them for the last 3 years and haven't found a single individual. But, you know, we could be looking in the wrong place. So we're working with actually Eastern Michigan University is going to hopefully be partnering with us next year to do some eDNA work, similar to what they did with the carp in the Great Lakes, to look for genetic presence of the animals.
Very interesting. And what about man-made ecological disruption? You've given us an environmental one. What about civilization?
Well, habitat loss is always a big issue. There's a lot of ecological changes. For the moose, for example, pre-1800s, there were a lot more moose. People came into the Great Lakes region and logged the area, making the habitat better for white-tailed deer. So white-tailed deer populations exploded. White-tailed deer are a carrier for a nematode parasite called brainworm. Brainworm doesn't generally kill white-tailed deer, but it's extremely fatal to moose. And so you see this major change in habitat, which makes the moose less likely to live in an area, and then you get this parasite load from the carriers of the deer. And so you can see man-made changes are have some direct effects on wildlife populations as well.
What's your biggest single environmental concern involving Isle Royale?
Increasing temperatures. We have a lot of things that live on the island that are very cold adapted. We have plant species that are called Arctic disjuncts that live around the Great Lakes region because it's kind of artificially cold. They're things that normally live several thousand miles more north, but because of the unique temperature climate we have on Isle Royale, we have things there that don't exist anywhere else, at least in the Great Lakes region. And so temperature changes and warming weather is something that we're pretty concerned with.
Of course, Isle Royale figures into this very interestingly because of the fact that moose are on the island at all in the first place dates back, if I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's because of one year that the lake froze over and moose were able to emigrate to the island. Do I have that right?
Possibly. It's hard to nail it down exactly. One thing, moose very rarely walk across the ice, so it's more likely that moose swam to the island than it is for them to have walked across the ice. And just a behavioral adaptation. Caribou walk across ice quite a bit, moose not so much. So our moose population on Isle Royale is thought to have come to the island at around the turn of the century in 1900. There's also some speculation that those animals may have been brought there artificially by people that wanted to establish a population for hunting. So there's some history that we're not entirely sure about how the moose got to Isle Royale.
We appreciate the clarification, and we appreciate your time. Paul Brown is the Chief of Natural Resources at Isle Royale National Park. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
It's time now for another review from current state contributor Scott Southard. Today he shares his thoughts on Neil Gaiman's novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane.
Pure escapism entertainment is a hard trick to pull off in today's fast world. Everyone is multitasking. Everyone has three different things going on at once. And then consider the world of books. There are e-books and iPhones, and we can check sports scores and emails on our Kindles. Heck, you can even see on some e-readers how others feel about the book while you're reading it. Did others like that twist too? Now you know. Yes, books can come with running commentary. So the great magic trick for today's novelists is to come up with an idea that makes it so a reader doesn't think about our wired-in reality. A story so captivating that we want nothing more than to sit and just take in the narrative, disappear from the distractions of our busy lives. It is definitely a challenge fit for a literary Houdini, and Neil Gaiman is that kind of a magician. Gaiman's new novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, is a story built out of a memory, and like our own memories, that information is fluid, foggy. Our unnamed narrator, while avoiding a funeral, stumbles into a house that he may or may not remember. He is welcomed in and is drawn to sit in the back near a pond. And it is there, looking at the water, that terrifying and wonderful memories begin to return to him of an adventure he had as a child. Those adventures took place with a girl named Letty Hemstock, who told him that the pond was actually an ocean. This is such a beautiful and precious tale that one can't help but feel it is a story best told in whispers. It follows in that new trend of magic realism, which are stories about our world with something more. And like most magic realism stories, it is like unraveling a sweater. You notice one thing off, and suddenly your entire environment has changed and needs to be put back together. Books like this always ask that fun question, what if there was something more to the planet than what we can see in front of us? And then throws possibilities at us, always just adding enough so we don't lose our suspension of disbelief. Could something like this happen? Possibly. I was completely hooked by this book, reminding me almost immediately why I love reading and literature so much. See, unlike films and computer games and plays, a book enters through your own imagination. It exists in us. It is a private conversation. Yes, as readers, we are part of the process. We aren't just having it shown to us. The writer constructs the possibilities there, just giving you enough for you to fill in the rest. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Letty Hemstock is the youngest of three generations of women living in a farmhouse, which may or may not be a farmhouse. Her grandmother might be as old as time, but she will never really say. Gaiman never explains everything we experience. We just see it through the narrator's eyes. And for the amazing Hemstock clan, everything that happens makes sense. It's real for them, not always worth explaining. So we go along like the narrator, trusting in these wondrous characters. Someday, someone will turn this into a film with a loud soundtrack, celebrities, and special effects, and someday it might even be a play, or a website, or an app. And at that moment, something will be lost as it joins the noise of our frantic world. But before it does, take my advice. Turn off all of the demanding electronics in your house and just read this book. The Ocean at the End of the Lane is magic. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Current State contributor Scott Southard is author of the novels A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. More of his writing can be found at his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our 2013 election coverage with a look at the race for city council in East Lansing. Also, we speak with members of the Meltwater Movement. That's a media organization hoping to make Michigan music more accessible. That and more Friday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.